I couldn't remember the recording for of the David Comes to Life, so I'm just looking at my old photos and videos right now. Honestly.
Full disclosure, I'm also looking at the Discogs page.
Yeah, I actually had to go to Spotify today to be like, which is my favorite song?
Matador, revisionist history, yeah. Matador, revisionist history, yeah.
To the Matador Revisionist History Podcast, where we get into the history of Matador Records as told by the artists who made that history. Actually, we're just making everything up. Anyway, I'm Matt Sweeney, and today I'm joined by fucked up Sandy Miranda, Jonah Falco, and Josh Zucker, along with Patrick Stickles from Titus Andronicus. Titus Andronicus and Fucked Up have a deep history that they get into in this conversation, and Fucked Up is celebrating 10 years of their epic rock opera David Comes to Life this year with a limited pressing of the album and a tour this winter. Titus Andronicus is touring this fall as well and releasing a 10th anniversary edition of The Monitor this October via XL Recordings. Let's get into it and let's get fucked up.
I'll start with the Fucked Up record. How the fuck did you guys do that? It's a really big, long record. And did you do it in separate chunks? How did this all come? Well, that's a really vague question. Did somebody in the band say, okay, I'm going to make an hour and 18 minute long concept record? Or how did that get started?
I think we just have trouble hitting the brakes on ideas. So when this was a record that we all wrote in the jam space together, and it actually kept coming. And we at some point during the process of writing these tunes, it was decided like, oh, this is going to be a rock opera, which was met with like a bit of pushback at first, but eventually we got into the idea. And then the material that we did have all of a sudden needed things that would fill the gaps. So we just kept writing. And it was like, it's very hard to press stop once you're rolling with an idea, because it's like adding ingredients to something you cook with too many. And then eventually, you know, lucky for records, you can kind of pare them back in the end.
But it's a remarkably sprawling record. I think the first thing that I thought was, I guess I had heard that the music was written separately than the lyrics, which is really not that big a deal. But on something with how your songs go, with the kind of the involvement of the arrangements, I was really curious as to how you would map out the vocals and how the vocals went with the instrumentals.
Fucked Up, the vocals always are weirdly the last part to go in. We never write to a melody, or we never write to a rhythm. It's always like front loading a huge amount of musical material, and then the vocals get written on top. So it's the inverse of what a lot of artists do usually, where somebody says, I've got this idea for a hook. We just start from zero, get it to 5,000%, and then put the vocals on it, which then match the music. And the record was started at a place called Treefort Studios in Brooklyn, where we just recorded some drums and a few guitar tracks. And then piecemeal over the next sort of year, it got finished in stages.
But the tunes had been written.
Fully written, and even some of them had been like fully demoed in the practice, just instrumentally demoed in the practice space. And some of the lyrics, for instance, didn't get fully realized or completed till, you know, like a week before they were recorded in some instances. So it's like,
I want to say it's like the last record that we all wrote together in our tiny practice space, just on like endless, hot, frustrating days. But it was the first record where we recorded it like, everybody one at a time at different studios when they had time. And that's like, now that's the norm. And like up until that time, we would all like kind of write everything or like work all the pieces out in that group. And then it was the last time we did that.
And then you give the finished pieces to Damien and you go have at it, or, I mean, does he just drop, are they just dropped in his lap and he has to map it out for himself as to how he's going to put in his vocals?
Some of the songs Mike wrote the lyrics to, some of the songs Damien wrote the lyrics to, and with David Comes to Life in particular, because it's a story, I think they each assigned one another different parts of the narrative to put into word form. But essentially, yeah, it got to Damien would get a completed song and say, okay, you're writing this one. So then you get the chance. Interestingly enough, though, the Queen of Hearts and I think Under My Nose, the second track on the album, when we were recording Year of the Tiger, that which is around the same, or it's, you know, just precedes David Comes to Life. We actually started recording David Comes to Life, and there's versions of those songs from the Year of the Tiger session that are like a total wasteland. They're like pretty poorly performed. We did them all in the room, and it's like really loose and shaky and not fully realized, and it's really not gelled. It's funny. I remember thinking like, we're not ready when we did those demos.
With Fucked Up, there are all these really beautiful and satisfying yet unpredictable guitar lines. Are those coming from multiple people? And like when you're saying that you wrote them together, is somebody like, okay, all right, cool, I like that part. How about we try this part to follow? I mean, is it sort of written in that kind of democratic bandular way, like a dude comes in and plays down, 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 then the other guy goes down, 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 down. Is it like that or?
Yeah. I mean, with David, it was exactly that. Somebody would come in with a riff, somebody would finish a thought, or somebody would come in with a complete song, and we'd work it out. The funny thing about David is all those guitar and bass parts are interlocking, and they're so interlocking because we all kind of had to think them through until they were ready to be recorded.
It's kind of stunning, and I guess that makes sense why the record, to me, tracks differently than most other records. There's this like massiveness to it, and there's a lot of thought, but it doesn't have that feeling of one crazy genius. It really does. It's a cool thing. It sounds like a lot of people who are like minded, you know, working together and actually hitting the mark again and again and again, which is cool. And it's so.
Just one quick comment about vocals being added last. I mean, usually, like, I just hear the instrumental takes when I'm working on them, and then when I hear the final the final product with Damien's vocals, they sound like completely different songs. Like, sometimes where I have difficulty even, you know, placing which song it is once the vocals are over. So it's kind of crazy how that can really change a song.
May I ask something as a fan of Fucked Up? As long as you're talking about the vocals for this particular record, from a fan's perspective, it seemed like this was the record where you started to introduce a lot more of the, what you call in hardcore, the clean vocals, like the melodic vocals. And you got Madeline's from the band Cults is in there. How was that? Was that an intentional choice, or did that just kind of happen? Tell us.
I would say it definitely intentional in two ways. Intentional because I think there's a kind of reflection that's our third LP, right? Third LP. That's a big LP for most bands. And I think on reflecting on what the band sounded like, we and even in discussion with one another, it's like a pretty full-on experience listening to an album of raging guitars and screaming vocals. So we had some luck with melody on Hidden World and on Chemistry. So we wanted to bring that in and give some contrast to the really hard vocals. And then you had like Sandy, Ben, and I who were willing to sing live. So all of a sudden these harmony parts were getting written. Like the harmony parts, the melodic parts that weren't guests or features were written as studio plays. But like all of a sudden, you know, we had people in the band willing to do that. Whereas up until that point, it wasn't really a backup vocals kind of group.
Yeah, the only downside to that is that people think that it's me on the record. So I always have to, like, you know, people come up to me and be like, "Oh, I love your singing on the record." I'm like, it's not me. And then you just see the life sort of like
just take the credit next time. Take the credit next time. Keep them happy.
I'm usually brutally honest. I can't.
I just.
I want to say that started before, because when Dallas Green sang on Black Albino Bones, which was on the previous record, Chemistry of Common Life, like I distinctly remember being in the studio and being like, we can't do this. Like, just as a hardcore kid, hearing these very like pitch perfect, melodic, pretty vocals, I was like, guys, just looking around, like, we cannot do this. So by David, it was like we had already jumped the shark. We'd gone through that. Thankfully, you know, people with a bit more foresight and musical taste.
I'm curious then, how did you live with yourself when you said we can't do this? Then you were like, okay, we just did it. I'm gonna have to live with myself and I suck, or like what was the process, or did you go, this actually sounds good?
Yeah, I realized it sounded good. I mean, other people, I probably have the worst taste. musical taste and fucked up, which I learned a long time ago. So I've learned to defer.
I want to know, did you guys and Titus Andronicus tour together around this time that these records came out?
If I happen to, in preparing for this podcast, I actually went through the official Titus Andronicus gigography and checked for all my favorite fucked up memories. And I found out that, and maybe y'all can fact check me on this, but I believe the first show we ever did together was November 5th, 2009 at the Brooklyn Masonic Temple. And I believe this was the show where y'all did Chemistry, as you call it, your second album, Chemistry of Common Life. You played that in its entirety, isn't that true?
That's true.
ChemCom, I call it affectionately. And you had Andrew WK at that show, didn't you? He was on the keyboards, right?
Yeah. I don't remember what song was. Yeah, he was. And he was playing, I think, keyboards. We were playing the song, maybe Year of the Dog live.
I don't remember what song he played on.
I don't remember. Does that sound right?
I thought he was up. So I remember him being up there for the whole show. And you had Vivian Girls on stage.
That's right.
Well, didn't you, for that one?
We sure did.
That was fun. I do have to say, though, that it was that show where I became I personally became an Andrew W.K. truther, because I had met Andrew W.K. at Irving Plaza when I was in high school, and the guy at the Brooklyn Masonic Temple was not the guy that I met. He wasn't the dude that I saw on the I Get Wet tour. I don't think so. I think it really is a clone or a replicant or whatever.
What was the difference?
His whole vibe, like his aura, like his appearance. He was just
so
different.
Wait, was the real one at the Masonic Temple?
I don't know which one is the real and who's the imposter, but I'm telling you, I saw Andrew WK in 2001, and the guy at the Brooklyn Masonic Temple was not the same guy. Or maybe he was. Maybe he was.
Full disclosure, I was roommates with Andrew W.K. for a couple of years. In between,
which one?
Well, I'm just leaving it there.
You're wondering which one now.
I think the most memorable fucked up and Titus shows for me were ones that we did in England. Like, I remember one that we did. It was us and Metz as well. that we did in London, I think at Electric Ballroom, that was just like an absolute ripper. And there was a tour with Patrick, I don't know if you remember this, where we were touring together and you like insisted on loading all of our gear after the shows every night because you were trying to get in shape.
That's right. Yeah.
It was like the most wonderful tour because Patrick literally loaded all of our gear, I think, into and out of every single gig in England.
Except for that one night when Mike saw that he was in a rush to leave and he saw that I was doing it and he's like, what is this? What's happening here? They're like, and y'all were like, he says he wants to do it. And Mike was like, no, everybody put the shit in the car. We're leaving. I have to go to a travel lodge. But yeah, that was a great tour as well.
Wait, but how long would loadout take? That's a lot of amps.
Well, it takes longer in England because of all the stairs.
True. I mean, he got pretty good once the Tetris stage became complete. I feel like you absorbed the layout of the van and then it could just go in. Although the first couple of nights, it was a bit like a scene from like The Machinist or whatever. Like,
no, I got to say, though, like 2 years basically since our last show, I feel like loading is just going to take 2 or 3 times as long once we get back on the road. I know I've gotten weaker, like my upper body is nowhere where it used to be. So, Patrick, if you want to come with us and help, that would be really appreciated.
Any time. Just give me, 24 hours notice. There's not a lot of bands that I will humble myself to roadie for, but like this band, this fucked up band. I gotta throw my body upon the gears.
Are you guys gonna do any shows together since you both have these kind of important records that are turning 10? Some kind of like you could call it Don't Look Back. Okay, we look back a little bit. That could be the name of it.
Looking back in anger.
Patrick, have you played any shows yet?
No, I have not. Not even a single one. But we're supposed to. We're doing our own headlining gigs in November, allegedly. I know y'all are waiting till next year, isn't that true? January, February or something?
Yeah, I was going to say, would you guys do something together?
Yeah, we should play
together.
Yeah,
we would.
Of course.
It would have to be somewhere really enormous, like Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, those riffs were meant to play side by side. It'll have to happen.
As long as we're talking about the David record being played in full, I did want to also say that we did another show together on November 14th of 2011 at Le Poisson Rouge here in New York City. And that was the one where y'all had the string quartet on stage. It was like in the round. You remember that?
Yeah, that was a guess.
That was, you played the record that night then too, didn't you?
Well, that was the big debut of David Comes to Life. And it was, what was that like a month after it came out or something? I can't remember what month, David. It must feel like it came out in October. But it was very soon after it had come out. And it was such an occasion to play that show. Number one, because after writing and recording this material, you really get it burned in your brain. But then after a while, it's almost like you retire the material when you get it on record. You kind of stop thinking about it. And we were starting to tour and we had our little songs that we always played when we were on tour from the record, peppered in with the rest of the catalog or whatever you want to call it. And then all of a sudden we had to interact with this stuff on a one-to-one level where all of, like you say, about the interlocking, soaring melodies, guitars, backing vocals, all these moving parts had to be represented somehow. And I mean, the best part about that show is I think the traction of how the tunes were written and how they were performed on the record actually did. I watched a couple of the songs from that set today just to sort of get in the headspace. And it's in a way, it's obviously a studio record. It's obviously an ambitious project that is something that is like put in its box of being a record, but it really is a live record. It's almost meant to be played live.
It's rock. Can I say one last little thing about that show? Yeah. Maybe to pivot into, you know, maybe what the David record has to say about anarchism or something. after that show at Le Poisson Rouge, like 2 or 3 hours after that was the night that the NYPD busted up the Occupy Wall Street encampment.
God.
So historic night in the battle against American capitalism. So I can remember because we played the Warsaw the following day, and I was all like I was all jazzed up and gassed, thinking about the you know the benefit concert that we were gonna put on like later that week, and the other band got people in the band were mad at me because I was like too quick to organize it. They were like, whoa, take it easy.
Did you play a concert?
Oh yeah, we did with Ted Leo and So Glows like that. Maybe like 5 days after that or something.
Jersey men, doing the right thing.
Yeah. Unfortunately, capitalism, you know, it's still it's ongoing. We didn't fix it with that benefit concert, but
yeah. Well, I don't see them having a podcast for their 10th anniversary. So
fuck yeah,
no,
that's right.
For the for those cops, nah.
With concept records, it's funny because there's always this sort of resistance to do them or resistance to them. But I would argue that the concept record is the actual foundation of rock music because records didn't exist. The concept album, because albums didn't exist until what, like 65 or something like that. And they were just meant to be collections of singles or, you know, a single with a bunch of throwaway stuff. And then some asshole on drugs decided that they should like make a story and take advantage of the 45 minutes that they had. I think it was The Pretty Things who first did that with SF Sorrow. Was that a record that you guys liked? Was that a record that you guys referenced? Because for some reason, the dreary factory weirdness sort of reminded me of it.
Well, I mean, I think I took it upon myself to constantly reference SF Sorrow and the Kinks, Arthur and Shams, That's Life, which is definitely, I mean, I think I'm sure the other people in the band might agree, but that I felt like I was imposing that. I like snuck it into a press release that we were SF Sorrow, because it was a record I was really, really into around that time. This is going to sound strange, but every fucked up record has always been a bit of a concept record. This was the first one that was had a concerted effort to explicitly say, I mean, this that we were telling a story. But every fucked up record has always had basically a singular idea behind it. I'm not the lyric writer, but this always occurred to me that like the idea of every record had a beginning and ending, and that was side A was the beginning and the end of side B was the ending. And that idea was a self-contained thing. Every single was a singular idea. And as a whole, it makes the sort of band narrative. And Hidden World was about, you know, the creation of the universe, Chemistry of Common Life, about nature, botany, biology, things like that. And now David is a love story. And because that's the most relatable, the most easily extracted concept, it got the sort of showbiz treatment that it's a rock opera or something. We haven't quite done the like mycelium, the great mycelium show band tour of 2035, but maybe one day.
Yes. You did do a tour with your Zodiac tour, had like a, what you're allowed, like a 10 or 11 piece band for that, weren't you?
Oh, yeah.
I saw that one at the Well. Doom Squad.
Yeah. Patrick, you know, my favorite memory of one of our gigs together in the UK is when you were going on this tear on stage, again, probably about capitalism, and you burnt a 10 pound note, and it kind of went. Nobody knew what to make of it. All the kids were like, whoa, 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 we're in over our heads here. And you, I have to say, you saved it brilliantly. And then you brought the half burnt 10 pound note to your merch table and sold it for a full 10 pounds and then crossed out 10 pounds and wrote 5 pounds because it was half burnt. Genius.
I don't recall this, but that was one of my, the burning money on stage was one of my, my bits back then, you know.
It's very
especially
like,
especially in KLF, you know.
It's very it was like KLF meets, but it's like with like a leaving kind of panache because it was just 10 instead of a million.
Right. On a budget.
Did you guys ever have a laugh or otherwise about the fact that y'all both made these, you know, concept records that were long and maybe not easy for everybody in the world to understand, clearly done because you wanted to do them, and yet they actually sold a few copies and made an impact on the mainstream to where like somebody like me even knew about them. Did you ever have a laugh?
The question, did we have a laugh about it?
Yeah, I guess that's kind of funny.
I guess we're doing that now.
Yeah, I know, but I'm saying, but then...
I don't remember that coming up. I guess it kind of goes without saying, right? That's because like fucked up Titus Andronicus fans of this ilk, like we get it, you know what I mean? Like we know what this punk stuff is really about. People used to say like every article would be like meet fucked up, you know, the band that's expanding the boundaries of punk. But that's like a ridiculous thing to say because punk is a totally like boundaryless art form. You know what I'm saying? Like there's nothing. It's just it's a music. It's freedom. You know, it's like it's without rules or restrictions or like there's not supposed to be a rigid orthodoxy. And like the stylistic parameters of punk rock as it was defined by like the Sex Pistols and the Ramones. That was just like reactionary, like to the things that were going on in the, you know, in the dominant culture at that time, you know, but that's not like a costume. That's not like a set of rules, as Ian MacKaye would sing, you know, so punk just means doing whatever you want. And so it's no less punk to make a, you know, 80 minute concept album than it is to make a 10 minute, you know, little cassette or whatever, single with all, you know, 30 second songs, you know, neither of those things is more punk than the other. It's just freedom. And you could do with that freedom what you will. So fucked up gets that. I certainly get it. You know, that's the foundation. It's understood. That's baseline. Wouldn't you say so? Jonah, Sandy, Josh? Isn't it true?
Yeah, I think that the thing about this record, like a lot of what we do, I think a lot of the music that we've made and some of the songs that we've made are kind of tongue in cheek and kind of biting and like baiting the public, right? Is that theme of trickery. But actually, like I was listening to David Comes to Life, and it's a love story, and it's actually a really sincere record. And I don't think that we were like trying to pull any punches with it. It was like actually the result of kind of some like cheesy sincerity, like wanting to write this like deep love story and kind of obsessively, like it's 18 songs. Like I look at that now and I kind of laugh, because I'm just like, it's a ridiculously long record. But it wasn't at the time, it wasn't like, let's put out 18 songs to fuck with people. It was like, it was actually just at the time we were like obsessive about writing this story, and that's just how long it turned out to be.
And you can make it that long because you're free, because you play by nobody's rules, right?
I mean, it's interesting because I agree that, to me, punk and rock are these two things that basically mean you could do whatever the fuck you want. You could pretty much like rock, if you call almost anything rock, you know, because you don't have to be good. In both cases, you actually don't have to be very good at music to make a record and call it a punk record or call it a rock record. And of course, we don't need to get into it, but it's funny because they both are also the two types of music that seem to have the most rules and the most reactionary fans. You know, rockist fans are that, and punk fans are that, and they both are like, well, that's not rock, that's not punk. But I do think that the lovely thing about both is you can pretty much call something punk and then it's punk, and you call something rock and then it's rock, I suppose. So it's cool that both you guys came to make these big statements, and they're both long records or albums about love. Unless I'm reading Monitor totally wrong, it is about love, right?
No, it's not about love. Who said
really?
That?
Then how come? Well, how come you're just, so?
There's a romantic subplot, or maybe right. Like one and a half songs, but the other eight and a half are just about like the binary of like the self and the other, you know what I mean? So like that could be, you know, it was just, you know, I wanted to talk about a trend that I saw emerging. Am I going off on too much of a tear now, fucked up? I don't want to get into a big thing about my
Go ahead. No, bring it on.
But I am interesting. You're saying that it's not about love, but then you're saying that you used a romantic relationship as a framework.
It's a subplot. It's in there, but you know, I think it gets to be slightly overstated, the romantic element of it. It's more just about, you know, I was noticing that, you know, I wanted to talk about this need I was noticing within myself and within, you know, other people and within society as a whole, like this need. I was just noticing that people were more and more were like defining themselves not by any kind of like positive quality or belief within themselves, but defining themselves in opposition to like some perceived adversary. Nowadays, you know, so like I was noticing that, you know, with the political climate of those like late Bush and early Obama years, those are presidents that we've had in America, you fucked up Canadians. And just that people have this urge to fight. Nowadays we call this, you know, tribalism. So it's just a lot of songs about, you know, fighting, whether it's fighting with your neighbors, fighting with your girlfriend, you know, arguing, you know, the dialectic, the clash, you know. So there's a little bit of love in there, but it's not like a love, it's not like a lovey-dovey thing. Not that there's anything wrong with that, fucked up, by the way. It is a great thing to do.
Your record was like, Monitor was like, almost like if you took like a Bruegel-esque painting or like a picture of the United States at a certain period of time. And it's not that you are trying to paint a picture of a country per se. You've zoomed in on all of these little, like you say, subplots, and you create this narrative of what people could have been thinking in your world. And this is the kind of story that, that runs through the record in a way. It's like, and all of those things are supposed to be relevant to the present day, the dialectic, butting heads and picking apart the sort of like nature of yourself versus the other. And it's like these, it's so detail oriented, that album, no?
Wow, that's so flattering. Thank you. It's comparing me to a Danish master and everything. Damn.
Well, I mean, pick any master you want. You could be the cover of this.
No,
this
I love Bruegel.
Six in Violence LP, if you want.
No, I mean he said it. You said it better than me. But yeah, that's true. You know, they old what's that trite thing that we always say? The personal is political. The political is personal. That kind of stuff.
I always thought it was avoid the noid.
Oh, that too. Yeah, and he's back.
And he destroys pizzas, man.
I cannot abide that.
I think it's cool that also in the cases of both records, you chose some pretty specific. Let's say in the case of Fucked Up, you chose to make a made up specific story, and. In the case of the monitor, of the monitor, you're using Civil War metaphors and New Jersey life and how much Boston sucks or whatever. But there are these very, very specific things. And yet I think because of their very specificness, they somehow become something that everybody could relate to. Wonder if there's anything to be said for that, or if I'm just making a random point, were you surprised that the records resonated the way that they did? Either entity?
No, I said, well, it's about fucking time that people woke up that this Titus Andronicus music is what's happening, you know?
Sick.
I'm tired of sitting at the kids' table like
I feel like when we were finished with David, I had this moment actually in the car. I think I was even with Sandy and Josh in my dad's Toyota. We were for some reason driving near the intersection of Yonge Street and Dundas. And I had just got a CDR of a mix of the song Ship of Fools. I think Ben maybe was in the car too. And we were just blasting this mix. And it was like listening to somebody else's band. Because when we were finishing the record, it felt like, oh yeah, this is good. It sounds like Fucked Up. Like we as a group will notice all the sort of amateurish things about ourselves, and me specifically, you know, I tend to like zoom in on stuff that I think, oh well, it's not perfect, so everybody will notice that this 4 milliseconds is not perfect or something. And as a whole, actually, when we started to take a few steps back. And I was hearing this song, which has like the AC/DC kind of intro, that guitar thing, ding, 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 ding. It's like Thunderstruck. And I'm hearing this coming out of like, you know, the car test is the ultimate test for how, if your record is balanced well. And we're driving through traffic in downtown Toronto at night with all the like the remainder of the neon. I was like, oh man, I had this like almost out of brain experience where I thought this is, we might've done something a bit beyond what we've done before. And so I was almost, I got, and at that point, I speak for myself, I got pretty nervous because I was like not really ready to accept that Fucked Up was anything other than this chaotic mess. But it was like, we sort of got dragged or carried across the threshold, you know.
Onto the A-list.
Yeah, that's right.
Onto the cover of Spin magazine.
Straight into the Poisson Rouge. Get your string quartets ready. Lock up your vitamin water. or whatever else was popular in 2010.
Some bands just, you know, some are born into greatness and some have greatness thrust upon them, right? We'll be right back. got to answer the call.
In your case, Patrick, when you finished that big sprawling record, you were like, yeah, this is fucking it. I can't wait for this thing to come out so I could fucking, so people can be slugged with this thing.
Well, like the very day after we finished recording it, we flew to England to play the famous Reading Festival at 10 in the morning for like maybe 50 soggy Brits. And then when we flew home and went right out on another tour for like 30 or 40 days while it was getting mixed. So I don't really remember a moment where we were like, ah, it's all done. Maybe when we like mastered it or something. With Greg Calbee, who I selected because I loved the job he had done on ChemCom, by the way, fucked up. And I even mentioned in the press release for the record, we've selected Greg Calbee to do the mastering, not because he's the most famous mastering engineer in the world, but because he's the only person that's worked on both Chemistry of Common Life and Bat Out of Hell 2, Back into Hell by Meatloaf, which was my other big inspiration at that time.
Did Jim Steinman write Back into Hell as well?
He did, yeah.
Rest in peace. Are you a Steinman fan?
I love Jim Steinman. Yeah, he's probably my most admired songwriter in a lot of ways.
You know his solo record?
Bad for Good, you mean?
The one with
the
scarf.
I have two. I have two copies of that. And my friend Eric, who played the drums on the monitor, he's not in the band anymore, but he's my neighbor now. He got me a T-shirt of that picture of Jim with the scarf and the gloves. Which wish I was wearing it now, but it's in the laundry.
Dude, that's fucking sick. Speaking of Andrew WK, if anybody's ever bothered to listen to Andrew WK, it's obvious that he's a big Jim Steinman fan. And Andrew told me that Steinman told him that every one of his songs is the metaphor that he has in his mind is a boner pressing through the jeans, the blue jean. And he says, or it's all about getting to every song has to have a point where the boner is pressing against the blue, against the jeans. I like that silence. What's it going to be, boy? As he said.
But I love Bad for Good. And I even love Meatloaf, Dead Ringer. If you know that record.
I don't. It's called Dead Winger.
Dead Ringer.
Oh, I thought it'd be cool. It's called Dead Winger. There's a whole concept record about the death of Kip Winger.
His duet, he has a duet with Cher. I don't know who you are, but you're a real dead ringer for love. Steinman wrote the songs for that, too.
Have either of you ever mastered with Greg Calbee? Have you ever sat with Greg and mastered a record?
Yes. No, never.
We attended the mastering session for... the Titus Andronicus record we're talking about, as well as the following one.
Greg's whole thing is to make it sound like nothing happened to your record between mixing it and mastering it, which is why he's my favorite.
Yeah, if you do it right, no one will know you did anything at all. Much like God.
Yes, you're talking about the Australian band God, right?
No, I meant like the concept by which we measure our pain.
That's the Australian band God. since we're getting into this realm, I would like to give a little note about how the fucked up record was mixed and how you managed to do that. Because I can't think of a record that has that many guitars that still somehow achieve. That it doesn't sound like My Bloody Valentine. It doesn't sound like Mud. There's a certain level of articulation and uplifting kind of shine to the guitars. That's really something. How do you do that?
Was it Shane Stoneback that made it happen?
It was, but you kind of have a Shane Stoneback vibe going on with your haircut and your beard there, Patrick. You have it's sort of a Shane kinship, but Shane Stoneback is the
is the person that mixed the record. And he's the one that he recorded the drums, and he recorded some of the guitar tracks as well. And so he and our guitar player, Mike, mixed the record together in New York. And Shane is a genius and an extremely talented person with an amazing sort of career path, going from being like a bicycle courier in Aspen to working with G-Unit to then somehow being saddled with working with Fucked Up. And like being PD Pablo's, concierge. But anyway, Shane keeps very strange hours. I was down for a short period of time for a few days to sit in on a section of the mixing. And Shane worked tirelessly, and then his mind and body completely collapse, and he goes into his little pod in the studio where we were doing it, which was like a sort of curtain and a mattress and a pile of blankets surrounded by luxury soap samples that for some reason were all over the place. And he would just recharge, and he couldn't be woken up. And then he would go back and work again. And the record was sort of mixed and completed out of my sight predominantly. And I think he just has a way, because he's worked in pop and because he's worked in rap, like pushing the idea of the whole with all these individual voices peeking through. And you know, the sort of formula for Fucked Up on David Comes to Life was guitar part A and guitar part B, guitar lead, which is also sort of guitar part AB plus, and then the bass centering the entire thing. And then I speak for myself, doing the drumming, I was like getting a bit better at drums. So I felt like I needed to do cool things on drums. So it's a bit like that video of this drummer's at the wrong gig, the guy in the ZZ Top cover band, like kind of giving it a slightly too much, I think, in retrospect. And some of the rhythms are like totally.
No, I disagree. I disagree. I think the drums are excellent and keep it there again. There's just something really nice about the record where nothing does exactly what you think it's going to do. The drum fills are really well thought out and off kilter in a satisfying way, in my opinion.
Well, that's what I'm going for. But I think it gets pulled in a lot of different directions. And because you have the classic, like you have an anchor in the rhythm tracks, which are sort of already a bit disruptive because they're interlocking. You've got an anchor in the bass and the drums are kind of mixed really forward. That just, it made space for all these places to have their spot. It also helps that people talk about the vocals in Fucked Up being the outlier because they're so aggressive and the music is so melodious or whatever, but having a vocal that's almost like another guitar or like a snare drum just gives all this space to all the melodic elements and stuff. And you know, think things sort of aligned nicely on that album. I think that's just how you mix it. Everything just has, it's like, I use audio Tetris, you know, it's the kind of thing, like frequency Tetris. It's like, what's her name? Hedy Lamarr, channel hopping. You know, you have to just keep changing your focus in order to get the full image.
Yeah, I honestly cannot think of a denser, yet more, you know, Tetris out and listenable, non-exhausting rock record. You guys really did something there.
When I met this guy Shane at that famous Le Poisson Rouge show we keep mentioning, he mixed
the show. He front of house at the show and he recorded it too. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
Well, the people at the record company were trying to tell me that he should mix the next Titus Andronicus album that we did after that, which he ultimately did not do, but he used the word crankability. And meaning that, like, you could turn it up, like, you couldn't hardly turn it up loud enough. Like, it would never get harsh, like, in, like, a bad way. And he alluded to some of the old Rancid albums of the 90s. He said was, you know, something was, like, a role model for him or a standard for him in terms of the crankability.
Yeah, that's a great word.
How did you come to this crankability? How did you connect with a G-Unit guy?
I think it was a suggestion from Matador, actually.
And, had he mixed something? Had he mixed something that they liked, or
Sleigh Bells, right?
Yeah, Sleigh Bells. I've lost the plot. I don't remember what the connecting factor was anymore. But I don't know, Josh, Sandy, do you remember what was happening in music at that time?
I don't remember much, unfortunately. Because we've done so much, like, honestly, like, without the photos I've taken or you know, like, emails and things, a lot of the past can kind of just evaporate a little bit. But, I mean, hearing you guys talk, it is sort of, you know, reminding me of some of the things that we've done. So that's cool.
It's all coming back to me now. Another Jim Steinman song.
I'm trying to remember when did Fucked Up do that thing where you played with a million people in New York on Bowery?
That would have been a couple years before that.
Yeah.
The 24-hour stunt show.
Yeah, that was insane.
That's right. Our 24th stunt.
That was October 14, 2008.
Is that right? God damn.
Yeah, crazy. I just checked my spreadsheet here. That was pretty crazy that day. We met a lot of people. Moby, Michael Stipe came by.
Little Johnny Malkovich.
John Joseph from Cro-Mags. I remember Damien introducing me to him. Both of your bands are what's the word? You know, you go for big things, and there's a decidedly non-lazy quality to both acts. And I think that you could easily point to the records that we're talking about as an example of this. And I guess I'm kind of curious where Fucked Up's work ethic came from, because it's pretty remarkable to have a band where everybody is so down to do so much and also to do so much together and not be about, you know, individualism.
I don't know. Back then we hit this stride, right? Like, we were always a very chaotic band from the get-go. And like, Mike, our guitar player, is definitely sort of set the pace for a lot of the things that we do. And then at some point, the sort of like ambition and the personnel caught up with one another. And it just so happened that that's when we started writing music that was bigger than our intentions ever were before. So I think even after when Chemistry was coming out, to step back, we were talking about the 12-hour show. That was when I think we all decided to go full time or something. And it was a big period of transition about understanding how to, I don't know, like, we all had jobs, but we weren't like sleeping in hotel rooms with the people in the different departments of our jobs. Like, you know what I mean? All of a sudden we were, oh shit, like we sort of have to function. And by the time David rolled around, we were used to touring. We were used to being in and out of different countries, different venues, different recording studios. And it was just one of these like nice parts of the ascent in which the attention the band was getting was meeting the enthusiasm that the band really had. And I mean, believe me, we're full of jagged edges. And a lot of that is like down to the fact that no band is not a group of single people, that like individual people that have to like find their way together. And, but you know, it was just, I don't know. I mean, I think it's probably projecting onto the past that like David Comes to Life represents a kind of harmonious period in everybody's like creativity. But it has this effect when I listen to those songs. It's okay. I don't long for there to be something different about those songs. Interestingly, I don't know how Sandy, you or Josh feel musically. Like, I wish we could have added more, done a riff differently. I don't know. But what do you two think?
I'm happy with the way it is.
I don't know. Like, I don't look back and think like we were all had super good work ethic. Actually, like, my feeling in the band is like, it's always one or two people, and like it changes, pulling the rest of us along. And it's like, it's actually way more of a struggle. And like, the nice thing about a record is that like, it comes out, everybody's put a bunch of stuff into it. And so it sounds like everybody is working together in lockstep and in harmony. But in reality, it's like, it's actually the result of everybody fighting and arguing and, you know, wanting it to go one way or another. But yeah, I think that was a time when it was like, everybody was like maybe pulling in different directions, but it kind of worked. I don't know. Like, I always feel like Mike just like pulls us along, or like he'll, you know, he'll have an idea for a rock opera and like we, some of us think it's like, you know, it's too much or like scoff. He's like, no, trust me. Like, just kind of, I think for that one and like probably Damien too, like they kind of pulled it out of us when we were kind of disbelieving of it in the moment. So I give them a lot of credit for that.
Well, I would say that we do have a pretty good work ethic as a band. I mean, we, you know, we've been a band for 20 years and we don't have a manager. We self-manage. And of course, that's not easy, but there's a lot of work that goes into it, especially invisible work and also not so invisible work. So I agree with what Josh said, except for the work ethic part. I think we do work pretty hard and have for a long time. I mean, maybe not so much now. Things have slowed down. We haven't played together. We're not really talking to each other as much. But definitely we've built something over the last 20 years that, you know, was based on our work.
Yeah, I mean, I remember even in whenever the hell it was, 2008, being struck. I was like, "Gosh, this is like these guys are on the same page," you know, in a way that many bands are not.
I mean, we may appear on the same page, but as Josh alluded to, behind the scenes, we're on different pages.
I would hope so, but still, it's the rare thing. More about what the eventually agreed upon. You know, what you walked out of your rehearsal space with and brought to the stage was something I think that's unusually. It's hard to put into words. It's like part of the appeal of this band is that it's a bunch of people going the fuck off and going kind of nuts, but there is this like. There really is an overarching agreement, it seems.
That was my favorite part of that era and that record, is that, like, yes, all the things that Josh and Sandy are saying are true. But at that time, I felt like we were firing on all pistons, you know, like we'd work towards this thing and all of a sudden it was, we would be playing these 90-minute sets. And yeah, there was lots of push and pull. It was a lot about like the energy of Damien as the front person and the band as this like prodigious musical entity, and why that was different on record versus why that was different on stage. But we all were like, much in the way that record was made, with disparate things sort of pulling us apart so much it operated like this magnetic force. It was like that on stage too, and it felt really good to roll in somewhere and like be able to blast through the set with like precision. And I remember you brought up the Vivian Girls a minute ago. We did a tour with them. I was in the David era, and one of them was saying, like, how the hell do you guys play so fast and you're singing these sort of Beach Boys harmonies at the same time as everybody's like sawing away at their guitars at a million miles? And it was just, you know, that made perfect sense to us because, well, that's what we learned how to do in this space. Whereas it's a totally ludicrous thing to imagine, like these like three-part doo-wop Everly Brothers sort of moments with 700 watts of guitar amplifiers and a guy screaming at you, bleeding. Like, it's quite strange, but for us, like, that was part of the energy of that lockstep of the time.
Yeah, it came across. I find myself thinking a lot about, I'm a fan of bands, you know, and I'm a fan of duos. I think it has something to do with the fact that you're not, there's something bigger than self-expression going on. You know, like I feel like self-expression is oftentimes when in podcasts, when people are talking to music artists, there's this sort of emphasis on self-expression, which always kind of doesn't interest me because it's sort of like talking. I think it's a lot more interesting to be in a band because you have to have an agreed upon sentiment because you have to connect with somebody else. You know what I mean? Like, and the idea that there's a, you know, that there's something bigger than your feelings about your life in this time, you know, that this is more about a band relating to each other and then creating this, you know, creating some kind of hammer to throw, you know. So I guess I would turn it over to maybe I'm kind of curious what if Patrick has anything to say on this.
About how important it is to express yourself?
No, about how important about the importance of being in a band where one's expression isn't the main thing, where it's an agreed upon feeling that can then be thrown.
Well, I guess I run Titus Andronicus with more of an iron fist than these fucked up people do, I guess.
I was going to say, like,
I don't really take notes like that from too many people, you know, like nobody gets to come to me and say, you know, the verse, you play the riff four times, let's do it six times. Like, that's not how Titus Andronicus does it. So I've, you know, the other musicians have a certain amount of freedom within their roles, but like, you know, they didn't. In the case of this record, like nobody was going to come to me and be like, I don't like this concept album idea. I want to do regular album. Like nobody would have the nerve.
Are you playing the leads on that record?
Some of them. There's like 20 or like 25 different musicians on that, I think. So I played like, I don't know, probably like a half of the solos and stuff, and other people who were, you know, in and out of like the, you know, the rotating cast back then, you know, all popped in for a couple songs here and there. My friend Andrew Cedermark played some important solos on it.
So when you're talking about, so who is Titus Andronicus versus who Patrick is? Is Titus Andronicus making these decisions?
Well,
and
it
you're
is
not?
it is a band. It's a band, like it is, but just, you know, I'm just the only one that has never quit the band.
I see. I guess then maybe what I was asking about is do you
that's call- one secret. That's one secret of the fucked up universe. I would love to learn how it is that nobody ever quits.
There you go. That's a good question.
You don't have any. You know, how come y'all haven't quit?
I mean, honestly, I've thought about it, but it's really hard to quit something that, you know, is a huge part of your life and has been for 20 years. It starts to become your identity and, you know, I mean, we're getting older now, like we're in our 40s now, or at least some of us are. And, you know, you start to wonder, shit, am I going to have enough time in my life to do something else that's great?
Because I never let anybody quit. Every time two people want to fucking kill each other, Josh comes in and sits them down and I work it the fuck out. And I've done that with every possible pair of people in this band.
So
and,
true.
Someone else has done it. Has done it with me too. But honestly, it's because we've just. I don't know. We're just somehow we're that kind of people. We're just not. We don't break up with each other. We just like somehow, you know. We just go on.
But that's so fucking rare. That's super duper 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 rare. You know.
I mean, in general, I stay at jobs for a long time. Like, I mean, I guess, you know, fucked up is a job. I don't know. I don't know why we all stuck around. It's funny because I had low expectations for this band. I still kind of do, I guess. But, you know, when you have low expectations, anything that happens is a pleasure. It's like, wow. Okay, that's cool. You know, I feel like if we came in thinking, all right, you know, we're gonna do all these things and like, you know, here's a marketing plan. Like if we started high, then I don't think we'd still be around, but
A general question to any of the fucked up people. Do people come at you with questions about how to have successful relationships since you guys have all been in a successful 20-year relationship?
That's the first time anybody's ever asked that. That's insane.
But it's true. I mean, like if I would probably turn to somebody like that because, I mean, it is a successful 20-year relationship that's about dealing with very intense emotions with lots of other egomaniacs, you know, you definitely have a perspective that not a lot of people have. And I would say, in addition to that, I would imagine it'd be kind of a positive one because you're like, hey, it's worth it. You know, it's worth.
If anybody, one recipe for success, if anybody tries to grow and do something better, you just fucking tear them down. Just, you know, never let anybody think that they're better than this because they're not.
Excellent. All right. That's good. That's the number one thing. Tear the person down. Do not keep the pruning severe. Prune severely.
Pruning severe.
Savage pruning.
I do wonder though, if like us self-managing, it maybe plays some part in the longevity of the band, just having agency, having control. I wonder if that has something to do with it. Cause I don't think a lot of bands at our level are still, you know, taking care of almost every aspect of the business of the band.
The thing with the manager is like, you can always get mad at the manager, right? You can always blame shit on the manager. So we never got that. We always had to blame shit on each other.
Well, the thing with the manager is I don't think they really like the person who cares the most about your business is you. And that's, you know, that's kind of how I see it. Right. I mean, we've tried out, you know, we've kind of talked about having a manager at one point. We started doing a bit of a handover and then it's like, well, then they want a cut of everything. And it's like, well, we've been building this for over 15 years. So, you know, it kind of didn't happen in the end. If we need help, we consult. Right. So that's kind of what we've been doing for the most part, taking care of shit ourselves. Oh, we need a little bit extra help in this area. You know, just hire someone for the time or hire someone here for the time. So I don't know. It is annoying, though, sometimes to do it, to do the work.
I think the long relationship is like an almost like an out of sight, out of mind thing. Like the band at some point became so much the focal point of all our lives. And of course, I'm speaking specifically for myself that like I actually like couldn't imagine a world in which something I was doing professionally wasn't predicated on my participation in Fucked Up. And so it's sort of always there, even though we've been dormant for the past years for obvious reasons, but like I sort of consider even if the band got raptured, the rest of the band got raptured tomorrow and Thanos sent them into outer space dust, I would sort of be like, well, I'm still Fucked Up. Yeah, we might play a show eventually. You never know. They're like, never say never. I think it's just never gone away. And that relationship at some point just became this permanent resident in the background of everybody's life, in which case that means that if it was like owning a house or having a pet or something, you don't get to extricate yourself from it in a way. You always tend to think, well, yes, it would be easier if my cat didn't have to have its bladder removed, but you know, I've got the cat, so I want to be there for it and care for it. So you do something about it, and it's sort of, you know, Fucked Up.
Coming back to the work ethic thing, though, like we've started these projects. Like we have this Zodiac project. It's like there's three more additions that we need, and we've always like I think for at least 10 or 15 years we've known the name of our last record, and so like we've always had many things on the horizon. Why? Jonah, what's the name of that? Was the name of the last? No, don't say it. So we just always had things to do. And it's like we kind of know the work is not done. So there's that. What were you going to say, Patrick?
Oh, I was just going to, you Fucked Up people. You keep saying like, yeah, you know, been taking off the last year, you know, isn't this the same year that you put out like a 2.5 hour long EP? Wasn't that this year? That's not very dormant.
Yeah. But that happened over 6 years.
That was nothing. Oh, that
you don't see, you know, fucked up standing in a circle, socially distancing from each other in the middle of a park in the dead of winter, just for kicks. You know, we're dormant. We're recharging for the big debut.
Hey Patrick, did you have any thoughts that you didn't share when Fucked Up was talking about the key to these to this beautiful long band relationship they had?
That was just a great opportunity for me to listen and to soak up game from these well-adjusted, emotionally intelligent punk legends.
That's how you file the Fucked Up section in your record collection, right?
That's right. Totally.
That's your genre.
Emotionally intelligent punk legends.
I do have a lot of fucked up records. It's true. Because y'all were so, that was one of part of my ulterior motive to go back to my roadie career. At the end of the tour, you let me have basically anything I wanted. So I got a lot of 7 inches.
Beautiful.
All right. Now comes the point, because we have talked, in my mind, had a really good long conversation, but I would like a question for Titus Andronicus about Monitor, or about the Monitor record, or about looking back 10 years, just a general question, anything you want to ask Patrick from Titus Andronicus, anybody from Fucked Up or everybody from Fucked Up, please ask. And then we'll flip it.
I want to know why the first solo, we talked about the solos, but the first tune on Monitor, first of all, that I had a feeling there was going to be one of these things, and I was like, okay, let's get my thinking cap on. But the first solo on the record is like, it's so like cut loose, and it sounds like choppy sometimes. Were you just like free improvising, and or you really like blowing off steam, or what? You know what
no,
I'm talking
they're,
about?
They're all.
Or is that on. You? That's one of the other musicians. Oh, he's dodging the question. He's out of frame.
Well, no,
you better be.
Which one
guitar,
do you mean?
That's right.
Are you talking about the?
Yeah, that one.
That one? No, that's me. No, that was composed. I just, you know, that's the only way I know how to. Only way I know how to do it. You know, my chops are such that I get by on conviction mostly. You know,
there's all the chops you got. There's chops galore on that album. And there's a lot of those like 5-1, 4-1 kind of like amen chord progression things that are really like sort of the sort of rock and roll finish. And there's all these like sort of intricate guitar parts, but that one in particular, it juts out because there's a section that's like sort of feels like you were in the middle of a take and the string went out of tune or something, or like, you know what I'm talking about? Like the solo in that song.
That may be.
It struck me that way too. I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. It's really loose. like, and also I like the use of wheedle. You do a lot of deedle. There's a lot of deedle.
Deedle.
You know, I was 24 years old. I was just taking the ride of my life. You know, it's as simple as that. You know, I had nothing to lose, and the whole world was laid out in front of me. You know, I was making a record that was actually going to have an audience. I might never have gotten a chance to make another one after that. It was just that kind of thing that 24-year-olds do when they have, you know, when they're long on ambition and short on talent.
I think it sounds great. Just curious about the intention, man.
That's kind of a self-effacing, I don't know how self-effacing you're being, but actually, I mean, it sounds like that in the best possible way. As far as the, a young ambition, you know, fucking going for it.
So I wanted to know, you know, like looking back at 2010 compared to the years that were like are living in right now seems like such a like a innocent time. And I, you like have the Civil War motifs in the record, which seem like super prescient. And would you, and that's what I, well, I was going to, that's kind of my question is like, were you, what do you think that like you were predicting something, you were seeing something that was happening, or was like, what was going on?
Nah, you said it. I'm glad you did, so I don't have to say it myself. But yeah, I saw it. I read the writing on the wall. I knew what was coming, and I was, history has proven me right, and now I'm back to try and monetize that.
Yeah, I was struck by that. There's a line about somebody 18 who's going to fuck you up at 28 or something like that in 10 years. Isn't there something along those lines? I can't remember that.
He's 70 some inches tall. He'll be chugging a beer. He'll be grabbing his balls.
Yeah.
He's just 18 for now, and he's going to murder us all. Nowadays, we call that toxic masculinity now.
Yeah, I know, man. No,
they didn't have a term for it back in the day, but I sniffed it out.
That's right. Is that a shub that you're fucking with? Are you fucking with a shub? What is that?
Oh, it's a capo.
It's a capo. It's a shub brand capo. I thought I was losing my mind.
Is it a shub?
That's a shub.
Oh, it is. It is. A, wow. Look at you. Aren't you? Do you play guitar?
No. I also recognize your Riley Walker t-shirt.
Oh, yeah. That's my man. He used to be my roommate, you know.
Oh, oh my God. I thought you must have been a fun roommate.
Oh, yeah. He's the best.
All right. So, Patrick, you got to ask Fucked Up.
Here's
a big question.
My question for Fucked Up. Fucked Up. For your whole career, like, there's always, throughout your catalog, you can really see, like, this momentum. Like, this is, you're like one of the most progressive bands out there. You never repeat yourselves. You always seem to be trying to outdo yourselves in one way or another. Very forward-thinking, progressive band. How does it feel now, though, to be, now you're doing something which is more retrospective. How do you feel that this fits into the larger mission of the band, this retrospective tour and reissue? And also, why this one? Why are we doing this now and not the ChemCom one? Or why not wait for the Glass Boys one? How does this whole retrospective reissue anniversary tour fit into the larger master plan for Fucked Up in 2021?
Well, I mean, Glass Boys was a flop. We already did the chemistry thing. But, you know, it's,
oh, did you do
Dreams
that?
Is only like 2 years old.
I missed the ChemCom show, if you really did.
And also, and also Matador is asking us to look back on 10 years and to talk about it. I suppose that's also another reason.
I'm not really sure where it fits in the master plan. Things just happen. I don't know. That's a really tough question to answer.
Well, I mean, it doesn't fit into the master plan in an intentional way. I mean, you're talking to the engine room here, not the bridge. But, you know, I don't think that it's every record turns 10 years after it gets released. And you know what? In terms of a master plan, there isn't one. But also, it's good for us to take stock of, you know, how the band exists, because David Comes to Life, I think, for lots of listeners and for us, was a big thing. And, you know, it's at this point, it's represented by like 2 to 3 songs in any given Fucked Up set a night. So let's shed some light on it. We did a lot of writing.
Patrick, do you play a More Perfect Union at every show? Is it the first song, the last song?
The last one every time. Okay.
Because, we play a couple songs from David Hemp's Life, like Jonah was saying, every show. But now we get to play it like we want to play it, not like they expect us to play it. So that's why.
Those are going to be some long rehearsals.
That's a CD quality pull quote.
That's very, very nice. Well, I guess the last thing I could say is, would you guys, if you met a young person who was, you know, in late high school or something like that, and they were really hyped on doing a band, would you say anything to them? if they asked you, could you tell me something? Should I do it? What would you say?
Do it. Always. Hell
yeah,
it.
Yeah. I would say do it.
Yeah. Bet on yourself, kid.
Don't count your nickels, punk.
There you go.
All right, no, don't take any wooden nickels.
and don't count them either.
Yeah.
Once you take fact, them. I mean, but don't take
ask
them.
Ask me that again in a few minutes.
Well, you know, thanks a lot. And thank you for your good work. And thanks for still being around to do it. It's appreciated. So I guess that is the Matador podcast with
congratulations to Fucked Up on a towering legacy.
Hell yeah.
Riches us all.
Yes.
Congratulations here. To Titus Andronicus on much the same.
And all the best in the future. I know that our best tomorrow, records are yet to come.
Tomorrow is another day, and the best should go to you then. No. We're not doing like a one-upping thing.
Although you just kind of did. And you succeeded. So we're going to, so may tomorrow be as big as all of your yesterdays or something like that. Thanks a lot.
Hear, hear.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you all. Yeah. All right.
Bye.
See you.
Bye.
Thanks. Nice to see you, Patrick.
Bye, Patrick. Later.
Great to see you, Fucked Up. Stay
good
healthy.
See you, man.
Bye.
Bye.